Marty Moscowen, welcome back to Radio Times. Cleanliness is important in maintaining health, but there is growing concern that the overuse of things like antibacterial products and attempts to live in germ-free environments could actually make us sicker and more vulnerable to disease. Joining us to talk about the downside of being too clean is Kathleen Barnes. She's a genetic epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University whose work focuses on clinical immunology and lung diseases. And Kathleen Barnes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. As an epidemiologist, is there a right amount of dirt and cleanliness from your perspective?
It's a terrific question and one that's stimulating a lot of conversation these days. So in terms of the right amount of dirt, it's a really complicated question because it really goes back to this notion that a lot of folks are talking about called the hygiene hypothesis. And this is an idea that's been around for a couple decades in the field of epidemiology and specifically clinical immunology to try to explain why we've seen a big shift in the sorts of diseases that have become relatively common, like asthma and allergies and some of the autoimmune diseases.
And we have seen an increase in those conditions or those diseases?
We absolutely have, Marty. So, I probably should back up and say a little bit about this notion called the epidemiological transition of disease. And this was really put forth sometime around the 70s, talking about an epidemiological transition in health and disease in modern society, where we really saw over, say, the middle of the last century to the early 2000s, a tremendous decrease in many of the diseases that really plagued us, such as rheumatic fever, measles, mumps, and tuberculosis. And at the same time, we saw this really rapid increase in diseases like asthma and allergies, as well as many of the autoimmune diseases. And what's really interesting about that is that in the world of immunology, we typically think of asthma and allergies representing one side of our immune system that's sort of an exaggerated response to things like house dust and cockroaches and whatnot. And we tend to think of the autoimmune diseases as being this exaggerated response on the other side of our immune system. And what we're learning a lot more about, which really plays into this notion of the hygiene hypothesis, is that there's another part of our immune system, what we call the regulatory T cell, that's in our immune response, that kind of helps to achieve this balance between one extreme versus another. And so the idea is, as we've over time become less and less exposed to the sorts of things that were very common in our environment in prehistoric times, we've lost that ability to regulate our immune system, if you will. And so we believe that's part of the explanation why we're seeing this rapid increase in these other types of, what we call chronic inflammatory diseases.
Well, let me ask you a non-prehistoric question, and this is the increased use in antibacterial products, the idea of, ridding bacteria of your kitchen and your bathroom. Is there any cause and effect that you and others have found, or at least some connection there?
There probably isn't as much as folks would like to think. So, there's certainly, we don't want to downplay the important role that sanitation has played and continues to play in some of the diseases we think of crowd diseases, like the common cold. I mean, clearly there's benefit to minimizing exposure to those sorts of viruses. But unfortunately, it's perhaps been a bit overplayed because what we're not being exposed to are not these sort of common crowd types of exposures, but what Graham Rook at University College of London has called our old friends. So the really ancient microbes that actually shaped our immune system, that's what's missing in our current environment. So you can use Purell all you want, but there are no helmets or ancient microbes to wash away. We're simply not exposed to those anymore in our contemporary environment.
One of the things that I read in preparation for this interview was a concern, a worry about bacterial resistance, the idea that we sort of don't have the kind of resistance that we need. Do you see this as playing a part in what you've been talking about and investigating?
Absolutely. And so we probably, a very strong case could be made that without doubt, one of the factors, the single most important factors that's contributed to this epidemiological transition that we've seen has been the overuse of products such as antibiotics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to give you an example, Marty, again, going back to our old friends and the sort of ancient microbes we were exposed to, those were things like, you know, actually herpes simplex virus, human papillomavirus, but a lot of the microbacteria and the helminths or the worms or parasites that we were exposed to. And then we moved into more of a Neolithic age, sort of pre-industrial age, there were larger groups of people together, so really more exposure to many of these things, in addition to exposure to new things like fecal matter from domesticated animals and pets, for example. You do begin to see an increase in, again, many of those crowd infections during that period of time. And then as we move into our modern period, again, with the introduction of things like antibiotics, we begin to seriously alter that microflora that we rely on very heavily, again, to sort of shape our immune system and to help us fight the things we really need to fight.
But this could be seen as an argument to go, you know, to go back to the good old days of our prehistoric ancestors, and perhaps, you know, they were better able to fend off some of the asthma and allergies that we're seeing today.
It's a great point, and in terms of the hygiene hypothesis, which actually was coined by David Strachan in 1989, the hygiene hypothesis itself came out as an explanation for this epidemiological transition, and Dr. Strachan's theory was specifically that the smaller number of families that we see with modernized society actually reduced exposure that children have with other siblings who are infected and so on, and that reduced exposure was changing, again, the immune response. A really major contribution in this area really came, however, from the study in Bavaria by Erika von Mudius's group. And this is where she looked specifically in the rural regions of Switzerland and Germany. This is a very large study of over 16,000 children. And they compared children who lived on farms versus children who lived in rural areas but not on farms. And what they found was there was almost a twofold increase in protection against allergies and asthma for the kids who lived on the farms. And the idea was, as you just said, they were exposed to these factors that humans have been exposed to for a very long time, which have really shaped our immune response. If you think about it, the shift in just the last 100 to 200 years has been a radical shift in what we're exposed to, the foods we eat, our physical activity, and you compare that to all of human history before it, it's not a surprise that the changes have happened so quickly, too quickly, for our immune system to catch up, if you will, to the things that we're exposed to now. Our immune system is still operating on what it was educated by tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years ago.
I mean, most of us do not live on farms or even have access to farms. Is that an argument for going and getting dirty?
It's a great question, and it's a question that comes up all the time. I think there's probably something to be said for folks not worrying so much about every little germ. There is a sort of priming, if you will, in our immune system when we're exposed to dirt, which of course has things like bacteria and viruses. So there isn't a case to be made that perhaps we've become somewhat maniacal about cleanliness and avoiding things that could help us in shaping our immune response. Maybe the best example is what we know about asthma and allergies. You know, two points I would make. One of the things we realize is that the most important period in shaping a child's likelihood of going on to develop asthma and allergies besides having parents with asthma and allergies, which is the strongest single risk factor for developing asthma and allergies, has to do with exposures of the fetus and exposures around the first few days of life. We don't know exactly what those factors are that the fetus and the newborn is exposed to, but we know it's very, very critical in shaping the likelihood of that individual going on to have asthma and allergies. The other thing I would add, Marty, that we know, which is a great example of this issue of our environment, is we conduct, so I'm very interested in how the environment interacts with our genetic background, because we know it takes both to have something like asthma and allergies. And so we've been specifically interested in how asthma and allergies possibly evolve. So we've been conducting studies in parts of the world where folks are still exposed to high levels of these microbes that we believe shaped our immune response. So specifically, we've been conducting a study in both urban and rural Brazil for the last decade or so, looking at people's exposure to a very common parasite called schistosomiasis. And schistosomiasis has been with humans since humans evolved. And so we believe that that exposure to these parasites has led to a very elegant shaping of our immune response. And so much so that without the parasite, without exposure to the parasite, our immune system overreacts, if you will, when it sees things that look similar to a schistoparasite, such as a cockroach allergen. So in these rural communities where people are exposed to really high levels of the schistosome worms, you almost never see folks with asthma or allergies. Mm. But when you treat them for their parasites and go back into the communities, then they report symptoms of asthma and allergies. Conversely, in the urban environment in Salvador, Brazil, where we conduct similar studies, we see somewhat of a mix of having both parasitic disease and asthma and allergies. We think that might have something to do with the rapid modernization that's happening in that environment.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but the takeaway for our listeners, which is that our immune system needs parasites or certain levels of parasites and germs just to be able to have an immune response?
I think that's partly a message. So it doesn't mean that we should all go out and eat worms.
Right.
Although I would add that there are a lot of scientists experimenting with what part of these worms could potentially be used as a therapeutic target for diseases like asthma, allergies, as well as the autoimmune diseases like inflammatory bowel disease, multiple sclerosis. So this work is going on. I think the bigger message is that we need to not be afraid of our environment and
Fair
to
enough.
Understand that we've been very much a part of our environment for a very, very long time.
Well, on that note, Kathleen Barnes, thanks for joining us in this portion of Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. She's a genetic epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University, and her work focuses on clinical immunology and lung diseases. And waiting in the wings, we have two guests. We'll be talking about spring cleaning, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Bryn Athyn College, quality liberal arts in a spiritual setting since 1877. Details at 267-728-4218 or brynathyn.edu.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now.
This is Piers Morgan Live. Breaking news tonight. A Malaysia Airlines plane carrying 239 people bound for Beijing is missing.
The disappearance of Malaysian Flight 370 has captured the world's attention. What is the inescapable pull? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. After a long and cold winter, spring is almost here. And now that the sun is actually shining through those dusty, grubby windows at home and we can see the dust bunnies and just how dingy and dirty everything is, we want you to grab a rag and broom and join us in this hour of Radio Times. We have two experts who will be talking about how to clean our house, how to clean our apartment. Jolie Kerr is author of My Boyfriend, Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. She writes the Ask a Clean Person column for the website Deadspin. And Jezebel, she joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Kathleen, Jolie Kerr, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us and joining us by telephone is Deborah Johnson. She's the Mary Maids Curriculum Manager. She's been working in the cleaning industry for about 16 years, training frontline employees. And Deborah Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email at WHYYRadioTimes, and you can tweet us at Marty Moss Cohen. Julie, I want to begin with you only because you begin your book talking about, perhaps even bragging about, how spotless your apartment is in New York City. Now, I am assuming, like most apartments, it's like a little bit of a shoebox, but would it pass the clean finger, you know, the glove on the clean finger test?
It would.
And is that because that's just the kind of person that you are?
That's right. I will say, I mean, as you guessed, it is a teeny tiny little New York shoebox. It's an old tenement, and so it gets very dusty. You probably would find some places where I wouldn't pass the white glove test.
Right.
And that's in part just because it's very old and the windows aren't properly sealed. And that's actually one of the things that's on my spring cleaning list this year is to reseal and weather strip my windows to cut down on dust. But yes, my apartment is very, very clean. Although I will say, it was so interesting to hear Kathleen talking about germs and germophobia and so on. I am actually not a germaphobe. And I subscribe very much to what she said about not going overboard and becoming maniacal in our fear of germs. So I thought that was a very interesting thing to hear and a point that I certainly want to make. I don't want to create an army of germaphobes out there at all. I just want to help clean up barfy handbags mostly.
And that's why you're here, Jolie. Deborah, let me get you in on the conversation and, just how clean is your apartment or your house?
Well, it's very lived in, but it is clean. I mean, when people come in, they do comment about my house is clean. But yeah, you will find dirt. I'm not going to say my house is spotless. We have a couple of cats. So there's the pet hair and dander with that. And then I have a 23-year-old that's just finishing college and her friends are in and out. And so, and my husband as well. So it, like I say, just well lived in. But we do clean. We have a cleaning routine, which is important.
Well, and I do want to get to that, but I do want to talk generally about spring cleaning. And perhaps I'll talk to you, Jolie. Do people still do spring cleaning? I know I'm kind of a cleaner person, but do people do this when the weather gets warmer and you can open the windows and all of a sudden the sun is shining through your windows? Do people get inspired to clean their house or apartment?
I think they do, and I think that that's exactly the reason why that all of a sudden that the energy that you get when you're able to finally open your windows up and feel that fresh air carries through, I think, to a desire to want to clean other things and to have that kind of fresh air feeling in other places in your house. So, I think bedding in particular, I know I really, the first thing I do with spring cleaning is I wash the heavy duty bedding that you don't do every week, the mattress pad, the pillows. I just, after a long winter, feel like I want those things to feel fresh and clean, and I think a lot of other people feel very much the same. There's also the other thing that happens in the spring, which is most of us tend to put our winter clothes away, and
most
of us tend to be very excited about doing so. I know I am sick and tired of looking at my winter coats, and I can't wait to get them to the dry cleaner and then put them away and not look at them for a few months. So I think that spring cleaning leads a lot of people to do that kind of wardrobe maintenance type stuff. of the ritual of putting away, cleaning and putting away. Hopefully they're cleaning before they put away. It's actually pretty bad habit to be in, to just put things away without cleaning them. If you haven't gotten to stains or dirt or grime or buildup, it can really affect the integrity of the fabric. And your winter clothes in particular tend to be very expensive, coats and sweaters and such. So you want those to last for a long time. Cleaning them well before you put them away in storage for, you know, 4, 6, 7 months, however long your summer goes, is a really important part of maintaining the integrity of the fabrics and keeping those things as long as you possibly can.
Deborah, let me go back to you. And is there a certain kind of dirt and grime that we do associate with winter? I mean, I'm assuming it's tracking in salt, it's tracking in, you know, muddy outside into the inside. Is there some kind of dirt that winter brings?
It truly does. Some of the things that you mentioned, salt, just the snow, and snow, of course, is melting, and then that eventually leads to a lot of loose soil coming into the home. And primary with that is having some walk-off mats so that when you enter your home that some of that dirt staying right there on the mat and not being tracked through the rest of the house. And pretty much like Jolie said, I mean, the sun just makes us want to do things. It's been dark, and you come in at night, and it's dark, and you're like, well, I'm done for the day. And then all of a sudden, the sun's shining with the time change, and it's like, woo, yes. I need to do something here.
Exactly. And how about, let me put this first to you, Deborah, how about the idea of all that clutter that we have collected over the months or perhaps even years? Is that a good place to start when it comes to something like spring cleaning?
It is good with spring cleaning and all cleaning. So a good way to divide it up is maybe in three different categories. So are there things that we just need to throw away? They've been laying around. We don't need them anymore, so can we just throw them away? We all like to donate and help others, so is there a donation pile that we can give away? And then just the organization pile that, yeah, it's here, but it really belongs somewhere else.
And Jolie, should we have an expiration date on our clutter?
You know, I think it's good to have an expiration date on your clutter. I don't personally subscribe to the if you haven't worn it in a year type expiration dates, but they do work for a lot of people. I think it's important for people to really think about what's right for them and to make a choice. I tend not to be very prescriptive with my readers because it's a big wide world out there and we're all very different. We have different mentalities, we have different emotions and so on attached to our things. So I think finding what's right and what works for you is a very good idea. There's a concept of the sort of landing strip box, which is when you're trying to declutter, to put things that you're not sure if you want to part with, can part with, should part with, into a box and leave it for 2 weeks. And at the end of two weeks, go back and assess what has your life been like without that item in it for 2 weeks. And that gives you the power to either take it out and keep it or to get rid of it. Or to just say, you know what, I'm not ready to make this decision right now. I'm going to leave it in the box for another 2 weeks. I think that's a very healthy mental exercise. And one of the things that it does is it helps people address the emotional attachment that we all have to our things, which is a really important part when you talk about decluttering and getting rid of things. It's important to acknowledge that we as humans have an emotional attachment to our things. And to really think about why you feel that way. Sometimes just getting down to the root of the problem, oftentimes even having a good cry is okay. I know that might sound a little bit silly to people, but I work with people oftentimes who are going through the process of getting rid of or contending with the belongings of loved ones who have passed on. As you might imagine, that's a very emotional thing for people.
Sure.
And what I tell them is to not be afraid to sit down and cry, that's part of the process of letting go. And then also to remind themselves that their loved one who has passed on wouldn't want them to be sad and wouldn't want them to hold on to a belonging out of a sense of grief or obligation. And a lot of times that's the thing that flips the switch for people in being able to part with an item and understanding that the item doesn't mean that you're parting with the memory of the person.
Do you sometimes feel you have to be a therapist, Jolie?
Absolutely, I do. I'm a cleaning advice columnist, and I take the cleaning part equally as seriously as I take the advice part. There are oftentimes some questions that I won't ever run publicly, but I will respond to personally and try to work with a person who's in some kind of distress, mm-hmm. whether it be grief, whether it be a mental or physical illness that they need help with. I do hear from people, particularly suffering from depression. I always want to make sure that I'm working with those people personally, just to let them know there's someone out here who really cares about you. And if I can help, I'm going to.
Deborah, let me turn to you. And this is a very sort of basic question going from what Jolie was just talking about. In terms of basic cleaning supplies, it seems to me if you have water, you have vinegar, and you have baking soda, you've got a mop, you've got a vacuum cleaner, and some rags, and perhaps a dustpan and brush, and maybe a toothbrush, you're probably pretty good to go. Do I have that covered?
Absolutely. Cleaning is always more about frequency than harshness. So we can use very basic things to clean with. My only thing in your list is I would make sure the rags are actually microfiber cloths,
okay.
because that has revolutionized the cleaning industry, just the way the cloth is produced, its ability to grab and remove dust rather than pushing it around, which traditionally cloth did.
Well, and I was also reading, I don't know if it was one of you or somewhere, that coffee filters are really good at cleaning windows. Deborah, is that you?
That was a very nice tip, yes. So, you know, because when you're cleaning windows, sometimes the fibers from a cloth are paper towels or people say newspaper, and then you end up with the print all right. over your fingers. So a coffee filter will absorb and actually clean the surface of a window as well.
Jolie, anything you want to add to that? Then I'll get to some of our callers.
I do. I have a very fun one to add to that. And I want to say I love microfiber. I have microfiber sponges that we use to wipe down our sink every day in the bathroom. I rotate them out every other day. They're fabulous. For the window cleaning, the newspaper is very frustrating because of the ink, except if you use the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal, I love this. The Wall Street Journal ink is and newsprint is designed specifically to not rub off on fingers. They're playing right to their audience with that they spend a little bit of extra money for their special printing of newsprint that won't rub off on your fingers. So if you want to clean your windows with newspaper, get the Wall Street Journal. That's the best one to use.
And that's Jolie Kerr, author of a book called My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbook and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. Of course, that would be Martha Stewart. She writes the Ask a Clean Person column for the websites Deadspin and Jezebel. Also with us, Deborah Johnson, and she's Mary Maid's curriculum manager, and she's been working in the cleaning industry for about 16 years. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email with any questions that you might have. Radio Times@WHYY.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Todd from Germantown to join us. Todd, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Great program. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'll take my answer off the air, but I live in a wonderful old 1910 building in Germantown, and I have about 1,600 square feet. I have lots of area rugs, lots of hardwood floors. I feel that I can't keep up with all of the dust all over the floors and on the furniture, and on the floors, especially in the corners. It seems like when I finally do get around to cleaning the floors, I feel like I'm cleaning up mud because there's so much dust that just accumulates. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk about some different methods of cleaning dust from floors and furniture, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Todd, just a quick question. Do you clean every week? Are we talking about every day? How often are you having this problem?
Well, I'm ashamed to say that I really only tackle it about once a month because, again, the apartment is so large and I just feel overwhelmed.
All right.
If I would do it on a more regular basis, it wouldn't seem so much.
Well, maybe. Let me find it. Deborah Johnson, let me toss that first to you. What do you think?
Frequency, again, does play a huge part
right.
in cleaning. So if he could. But there's so many things that can help you now, and that depends on your pocketbook. So there are different vacuums that are out there, the robot vacuums that can actually help you in between, depending on how much. Now, if you buy a basic one, you cannot set a schedule for it. But if you can go up in price and get a better vacuum, you can actually schedule it to clean while you're at work. So there are tools that can help you besides you doing it if you do not have the time or the frequency.
But probably once a month is not enough, Jolie.
No, I don't think so. And I love what Deborah said about frequency. So I've actually got some pretty concrete tips. I do think the one about the robot vacuum, if you can throw money at the problem, by all means. Another suggestion to make in terms of vacuuming is the new generation of cordless vacuums are actually quite good. Historically, cordless vacuums have been virtually useless. They hadn't had the suctioning power. The charge time power wasn't really good enough. The new generation of cordless vacs that we're seeing, and these are uprights, not, and I'm not talking about handheld, really have addressed those problems. So if you've got some money, Dyson makes a great one. I have it. I got it. I exchanged a wedding gift I didn't want, and I got a crazy Dyson vacuum with my husband's blessing. I love it. Shark makes a product that's very similar to that Dyson for about half the cost. It's in the, I would say, $175 range. That makes it really easy, especially when you're talking about vacuuming a large space, right, because you're not having to bend over and plug and unplug and carry a cord around and so on and so forth. So more frequent vacuuming, getting a better vacuum that's going to work for your space, might be better. Another thing, particularly around those corners and the baseboards, is to dust using a dryer sheet. The dryer sheet will pick up the dust, but it's also going to leave behind a very fine coating of the product that's in the dryer sheet. That's going to help to repel dust just a little bit longer. Huh? It's not going to prevent dust, but it's going to repel the buildup just a little bit longer. And so, again, if frequency really is an issue for you, you might want that that sort of time stretch little trick that I have up my sleeve.
Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Deborah, what's the dirtiest room in the house or the apartment?
Typically the bathroom.
Surprise.
If you're talking about germs, that would be the kitchen. But just as far as dirt, because most people avoid the bathroom because it's a little more labor intensive with the shower.
And you had mentioned hair earlier. I mean, you know, hey, we're talking about cleaning houses, so we're going to have to talk about things like that. How much of cleaning up a house or apartment is dealing with hair, Deborah?
It really depends on the homeowner. Some people just shed more hair than others. In the cleaning industry, what we have found is if a home is like that, we can go into the bathroom and we'll just vacuum first. And if the shower's dry, we might use a smaller vacuum to even just get the hair out first. But if not, I mean, typically you do want to clean dry first and then wet but if the shower's clean, then that hair's wet and you're just going to have to deal with it. But, hair is part of it, so trying to keep that up, and that does make the room look cleaner when the hair is not present, so it can come back to frequency again.
Again. Well, you know, and I'm sure, Jolie, you want to add to this. We have to just take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about spring cleaning, and Deborah Johnson, again, the curriculum manager for Merry Maids, Jolie Kerr, author of My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbook and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha, and again, she writes the Ask a Cleaner Person column for the websites Deadspin and Jezebel. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcomes clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and weight management. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Beck Institute proudly supports WHYY.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be.
I came to school not understanding the loans that I was taking on, and I'm realizing more and more how much debt I'm going to be in once I graduate college.
College delivers tough lessons about debt that millions of students learn too late. The high price of college's hard knocks, next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
So many questions, so little time. We are talking about spring cleaning. I just got an earful during that 90 seconds of questions to ask our guests, Jolie Kerr, author of My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag, and Deborah Johnson, Mary Maid's curriculum manager. The phones have exploded. The emails are coming in. And Jolie, did you want to just make a quick comment about hair? Because I know, having read your book, I know that's something you spend a fair amount of time on. Do we have Jolie? Oh, I don't think we do.
Yeah,
go ahead, Jolie. I'm sorry. Oh. You didn't hear me.
No problem. Hairable weeds is my cutesy little name for those clumps of hair that go drifting around. Really, just like Deborah said, constant vigilance with the hair. A handheld vac is a great thing. I recommend, and this is actually what we do in our house, is I leave one right in the bathroom. So we can just quickly, after we do our hair, just do a quick, less than 30-second once over to pick up the hair that's been left behind. And actually, it's one that I hear oftentimes from my male readers when they first move in with girlfriends.
Right.
They cannot believe the hair.
Well, welcome to living with somebody else. We had an email. The best way to clean soap scum from a black shower door. Deborah, soap scum, what do we do about that?
Yeah, soap scum does build up over time. And again, with harshness and frequency, if you leaving shower doors open helps the air just to circulate so that you're a little bit more preventative, as well as just wiping the door down after showering so that it doesn't have time to build up. There are many products on the market, but this is not going to be a quick fix. This right. is something that's diligent, and you have to hang in there with it to ever conquer the soap scum.
And using toothbrushes and things like that to get into the area?
In the tight areas. Another revolution that's coming to the cleaning industry is steam. And with steam, you're using hot water. It's the temperature of the water. And actually, steam is very effective on soap scum as well.
Interesting. Jolie, we had a question actually from our engineer about food odor. Is there any way to sort of get rid of food odor once you've done a, cooked dinner or something like that?
Absolutely. So I'll tell you, I cook a lot of curries in my house. I'm half Indian. So as you can imagine, lingering smells in our tiny, tiny apartment is an issue that we have all the time when I'm cooking curry. My favorite odor neutralizer for the home is white vinegar. Just put a little bit of white vinegar, maybe a cup or so, into a small bowl, set it out, and it will just absorb the odors, usually within an hour or two. I think that's just a great odor absorber. It's also important to understand the difference between an odor absorber and an odor masker. A candle would be something that would mask an odor. But what you're going to end up when you do that is you're going to end up with candle-smelling curry scent in your house. So we like to remove the odors and then introduce a pleasant new odor on top of that.
And vinegar, I mean, some people would say, ooh, vinegar doesn't smell so great, but not an issue, Jolie?
No, it's a very mild scent, and the smell of it will dissipate fairly quickly over time. You're not using so much that it's going to overpower the scent in the home. If you've got all your windows sealed up and you leave it sitting sealed up for a week or so, yes, your house is going to smell like vinegar. But with human movement coming into the house, opening the door, a cup of vinegar sitting out on the countertop isn't going to make your house smell like salad dressing.
Deborah, I have an email from Kristen for you. What does your guest have for suggestions for dealing or training a messy husband? And then she writes, I was thinking of a shock collar. I don't know whether you've had to deal with this at Mary Maid's or not. Do we have Deborah? I think we have lost Deborah. Let me put that to you, Jolie.
Okay. Well, I have to tell you, I hate that question because I hate the notion. Yeah, I do. I hate the notion of the beleaguered wife training the messy husband. I think it's just insulting to men. I think it's insulting to women. You know, I sort of hate that question. I think sitting down and having an honest conversation about the way in which you're running your household together is probably the best way to go with it. You know, I think it's a joint household. My husband and I are newlyweds, and we're just figuring out how to live together. We didn't live together before we were married. Right. And we see our home as exactly that. It's our home. So we share responsibilities, and we talk about it. You know, it's not this antiquated sort of, you know, commercial notion of the, you know, the beleaguered housewife and the slobby husband.
No, I hear you. And I appreciate
and
that.
And I think it would be insulting to her husband to be spoken to in a way in which she needs to train him.
And I think for a lot of couples, or a number of couples, they sort of figure out the chores or the duties get divvied up, because one person likes to do dishes, one person actually likes to vacuum, and you over time can negotiate who does what.
Exactly. I love that approach. I think it's a much more respectful approach to say, you know, let's negotiate. Let's figure out what I like, what you like, or what I hate least. Maybe
exactly.
More fair way to describe it.
Deborah Johnson, do we have you back?
I am back, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm not sure what happened to you, but we're happy to have you back. Let me get another caller to join our conversation. We have Jennifer from Newark, Delaware. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I love your show.
Thank you.
And we are having to move from Delaware to the Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia area because my husband's getting transferred for his work. So we've lived in our house for like 11 years.
Right.
It's lived in, but it's clean. But I am going through, and I've been checking stuff out. I've been giving stuff to Goodwill. What do I need to do to make the house you know, cleaning and to be able to sell it, so I can get rid of the house fast, so I can move to where I'm going and get a new house and get set up in a few months.
Oh, you got a lot riding on that question. Let me see what Deborah Johnson has to say. Deborah, are there certain things she should do to get a house ready for sale?
Definitely. You know, walking in and just, people are going to look up. Sometimes we've been in our homes for so long, we forget to look up. So make sure that ceilings and the tops of the home, if your vents are up there, have the cobwebs are removed, and things are just clean. So don't forget to look up. If you've got ceiling fans, people forget to turn them off, and there's a layer of dust caked above and below the fan blade. So these things, the globes that are on the ceiling fans, making sure the windows are clean so that they can see inside and out, the baseboards. It's going to be a little more intense, and as well as it sounds like she already has a good hand on clutter,
right.
But sometimes when the house is on the market, you end up putting some things in a little storage unit just so when people come in, they do see clear spaces and not just the things that we have in our corners. It shouldn't look personal. It should be just very open, very clean, and, you know, there's things there that we've probably gotten used to, so you may need to have a friend or a fresh set of eyes come in and say, yeah, that's not so good because you've looked at it so long you've forgotten about it.
Jennifer, good luck, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jolie, when you title a book, My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag, you're going to get asked, I guess, probably every interview you do about what you do if your boyfriend barfs in your handbag. Well, what's your advice?
Sure thing. Well, first of all, I want to say to the boyfriends of the world, please don't barf in our handbags.
Please,
just
right.
Don't. Please don't do it. So in the case of this was a real question. The problem was not so much the actual vomit itself. The girl with the handbag got it home. She this is disgusting, but she
it
scooped
is disgusting.
Out the it is disgusting. These things happen. Look, we get sick, you know. So she scooped out the vomit and she cleaned it out with some sudsy water. So not a lot of more suds than water. And so all the staining and the debris was gone, but what lingered in that bag was the smell. And as you might imagine, we don't want that. So what I told her to use, because it was a leather handbag, was to use the same kind of products that you would use on athletic shoes. Oftentimes our sneakers are made of leather. And so odor-neutralizing athletic shoe spray is safe to use on leather. So indeed, that's what she did. You know, just Dr. Scholl's makes one, you know, so on and so forth. That's what she used. It took the smell right out. She still has the bag. And believe it or not, she still has the boyfriend. So it was a very happy ending all around.
Well, I had a question about that, which you answered. Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Nancy from Center City, Philadelphia, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I have a lot of lung problems. I had lung cancer and asthma, and I've had to I get very affected by cleaning products that have strong odors, mm-hmm. and many of them do. Now, there are laundry products and dishwashing products that are available now for those things, and I have a steam cleaner that I use for the bathroom, although it's rather unwieldy, but I'm looking for recommendations for cleaning products for stainless steel in the kitchen and granite in the kitchen and also wood furniture cleaner and polish that don't have strong odors. They're very hard to find.
Well, Nancy, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And if we can do this perhaps without product names, Jolie, let me go back to you only because I know in your book there are lots of lists of things to use to clean certain items.
Yeah, I think probably in this case, you know, white vinegar, if that scent doesn't bother her, because it's it doesn't contain chemicals, which is, I imagine, actually what the problem is for her, might be a good solution. That's not going to work for granite. You don't ever want to use anything with an acid on granite. For her stainless steel, products like Bon Ami might be a good thing for her to do. Those are very old-fashioned. You know, they're not full of chemicals. That might be a good solution for her. I'm not at the top of my head thinking of a furniture cleaner. Microfiber cloths actually might be the solution. No cleaner at all, just to use the cloth. I bet Deborah is probably going to have the answer for that.
Well, let's find out. Deborah, go ahead.
I'm in agreement with Jolie in that microfiber, you do not even have to have a furniture polish. You can dry dust, and it would remove. And then off-the-shelf products, they're the DFE products, which is a green certification that's approved by the EPA because they look at the product. So they don't have as much scent and smell, but as Jolie said, vinegar is good as long as you're not using natural stone as well.
Nancy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have a tweet from Lucy, and this is for you, Deborah. She wants to know, is there a protocol for cleaning before a cleaning service comes?
What we ask, because it's your personal space in your home, so we're not quite going to organize things the way that you do. So if you can pick up before we come in, that allows us to concentrate on the cleaning. Otherwise, you know, we have to pick up things like, and I'm just talking about clothes,
sure,
or things that are not in place. Because, again, we don't go inside your closets or drawers and things like that. So it doesn't quite look as clean if everything's not picked up. So the picking up is the cleaning before the cleaner comes.
Joel, you have a section on cleaning makeup brushes. I mean, and I think, you know, people often will forget about doing that, just using the brushes every day. What is the best way to do that?
Absolutely. Just a little bit of makeup brush cleanser. And there's actually a DIY recipe in the book for if you want to make your own makeup brush cleaner. You can also buy a commercial one, you know, any place where you buy makeup. It is important to clean your brushes fairly regularly for a couple of reasons. One, we don't all tend to use the same makeup over and over again. So if you've switched products, the old product will still be on your brush. More importantly, the oil and loose skin that comes off when you use your makeup brush stays on that brush, and it breeds bacteria. That bacteria is then going right back onto your face, so it can cause acne, which none of us want. It can also, over time, really bad bacteria develops. If you have any open cuts on your face at all, things can get infected, so you don't want to do that.
You also say, speaking of brushes, make sure after you clean the toilet that you also clean the toilet brush. Right, Jolie?
Yes, absolutely. That was actually a question that someone asked me. You know, do I need to be worrying about this? And, you know, of course, if you're sticking this thing in your dirty toilet and then taking it out, it's dirty. I mean, it's not going to kill. Again, this kind of goes back to the germaphobe thing. I don't want people to get so freaked out that, you know, that life becomes unreasonable. That's silly. We should live our lives. We should have a wonderful time in life. We should not worry too much about making messes and germs and so on and so forth. But from time to time, certainly cleaning the tools that you use to clean is a very, very good thing to do.
Deborah, do you have a suggestion for a good degreaser?
Well, of course, with degreasers, we're having to get things, grease just leaves behind a lot.
So, it does.
Basically, I mean, vinegar, again, works well. Baking soda that you can mix together and kind of form a paste and then put that paste on and allowing a product to sit on a greasy surface or even like a shower wall, it gives the product time to work, so we're not talking forever. The temperature will help, so if you can warm the oven a little bit after you apply it, you don't have to have it scalded hot, and then to rinse. Again, using our microfiber because it's going to, there are actually two kinds of microfiber. This one is a little bit different from dusting. It has a little more scrubbing ability because you'll still have to scrub some.
We're almost out of time, Jolie, but we haven't talked about elbow grease. And, you know, part of cleaning is getting down on your hands and knees, right?
Absolutely it is. And I'm going to tell you, Deborah's a better woman than I, because when it comes to grease, I go straight for the ammonia.
Do you?
I want the chemical, yeah, because the elbow grease, it's a little too much for me. It is true that whenever you're using a more, or not whenever, but generally speaking, when you're using a more natural, less chemical-based product, you're going to have to put more elbow grease into things. And I heard you mention hands and knees, which is my preferred method of washing the floor. People tend to hate me when I say that, but I really do think it's the best. It just works the best.
Well, on that note, Julie Kerr, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And Deborah Johnson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Deborah Johnson, Mary Maid's Curriculum Manager. Jolie Kerr, author of My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbook and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. And she writes the Ask a Clean Person column for the websites Deadspin and Jezebel. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and check out our homepage. You can continue the conversation on our homepage. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter and download podcasts of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.